This recording is brought to you from the Jefferson Society by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find more local news and events at cvillepodcast.com. Poet, author, and former University of Virginia student Edgar Allan Poe presented a selection of his best-known works to the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society on Friday, November 13, 2009. His recitations included El Dorado, The Raven, and a thrilling enactment of The Tell-Tale Heart.
Thank you. Things have changed. Good evening. I am Edgar Allan Poe. I was born 200 years ago this year. 40 short years after that, I was found not far from here, actually, on the streets of Baltimore in a delirium. A three-day coma ensued, after which I awoke, begged God for mercy on my soul, and died. I come alive tonight through the power of words, for I was a writer and a poet, and as such, my thoughts and my feelings shall outlive everybody in this room. but enough about me. Long before I made the scene, it had been written that all the world is a stage and we are but merely players. If this is true, if the bard was correct when he wrote this, then it begs a few questions in my cynical mind anyhow. First of all, if this is just all some sort of play, and we're all actors in this play, then who sits in attendance and watches us perform? And if this is just a play and we're all just actors, then what is the nature of this play? Is it perhaps a romantic comedy or some sort of farce? And of course, if this is just a play and we're all just actors, who's the hero of this play? Let's dig a little deeper, why don't we, with my poem, The Conqueror Worm. Lo, 'tis a gala night within the lonesome latter years. An angel throng, bewinged, bedight in veils and drowned in tears, sit in a theater to see a play of hopes and fears, while the orchestra breathes fitfully the music of the spheres, mimes in the form of God on high, mutter and mumble low and thither fly. Mere puppets, they, who come and go at the bidding of vast formless things that shift the scenery to and fro, flapping from out their condor wings, invisible woe. That motley drama, oh, be sure, it shall not be forgot, with its phantom chased forevermore by a crowd that sees it not, through a circle that ever returneth into the self-same spot. And much of madness, and more of sin, and horror, the soul of the plot. But see amid that mimic rout, a crawling shape intrude, a blood-red thing that writhes from out the scenic solitude. It writhes, and with mortal pangs, the mimes become its food, and seraphs sob at vermin fangs, in human gore imbued. Out are the lights, out all, and over each quivering form, the curtain, a funeral pall, comes down with the rush of a storm, while the angels, all pallid and wan, uprising, unveiling, affirm that the play is the tragedy, man. And its hero? The conqueror worm. Thank you. Thank you very much. You guys are an inspiration to beatniks all over, I guess. It's fun to have poetry night because the snapping fits right in, you guys. Thank you very much for that. This is actually more fans than I had back when I was alive. You realize that, especially here at the college. I did all right, though. I became, in my freshman year, I was secretary of this fine organization. Thank you. I ran for treasurer, really, but I had a gambling problem. They wouldn't trust me. So, no, I kid. I kid the Jefferson Society. I don't think I haven't noticed you guys wearing around sweatshirts with my likeness on them that say dropout under it. please, kids, remember, I didn't drop out because I didn't have any interest in going to school. I just, well, like I said, I had a gambling problem and a few other things you guys wouldn't understand. Back when I went here, this was a real party school. I'm sure things have changed. I don't even see a keg in here. Has something changed there? Huh? I might have been part of why they don't allow that anymore. But anyhow, back to the show. Back when I was alive, people used to think that I was obsessed with death because, well, let's face it, that's all I ever wrote about. Here, thank you, by the way, to whoever's coming to my grave every year and leaving behind the roses and cognac. Is that someone in here? So back when I was alive, people used to think that I was obsessed with death because, let's face it, that's all I ever wrote about was death and the loss of hope. But I would say it was really the other way around. Rather than me being obsessed with death, death was obsessed with me. You see, it stalked me my entire short 40-year-long life and took from me every single woman I ever loved, including my own dear mother when I was not even 3 years old, and then Mrs. Allen, my adoptive mother, and then my young wife. And so what I did at a very early age, before I even came here to school, I started to use the most powerful thing we have as human beings, the one thing that sets us apart from all the other animals. Our ability to use language, words, are the most powerful thing we have. We can start wars with words. We can end, almost always end a war with words, a treaty. You can make your best friend laugh with your words. You can make your best friend cry. And so I used words, our most powerful thing, to try and understand the most mysterious thing about life, which, of course, is death. With all your knowledge now about DNA and all that stuff, which, by the way, we knew nothing about. Otherwise, maybe I wouldn't have married my cousin. You guys have come a long way in your knowledge about life, but I don't know how far you've actually come in your knowledge about death. But please, this next poem is a poem I wrote. I'm just going to bring a chair out here. I feel more comfortable just in case I get dizzy. We were over at the old Ivy, it's called now. Back when I went there, it was just called the Ivy. But anyhow, had the same waitress, oddly enough. 170-something years old, no upper lip. Anyhow, enough about our dinner experience. This next poem I wrote when I was quite young, before I came here. And in this poem, I try and understand what it must be like to actually die. What is that moment like? What is that day like? And I called this one Spirits of the Dead. Thy soul shall find itself alone, mid dark thoughts of the gray tombstone, not one of all the crowd to pry into thine hour of secrecy. Be silent in that solitude, which is not loneliness, for then the spirits of the dead who stood in life before thee are again in death around thee, and their will shall overshadow thee. Be still. The night, though clear, shall frown, and the stars shall not look down from their high thrones in the heaven, with light like hope to mortals given. But their red orbs, without beam to thy weariness, shall seem as a burning and a fever which would cling to thee forever. Now our thoughts thou shalt not banish, now our visions ne'er to vanish. From thy spirit shall they pass, no more, like dewdrop from the grass. The breeze, the breath of God is still, and the mist upon the hill, shadowy, shadowy yet unbroken, is a symbol and a token. How it hangs upon the trees, a mystery of mysteries. Thank you. Just water tonight for old Edgar. Not much left to my liver. As a matter of fact, you'll have to excuse me. I'm just getting over being dead. Oh. See, you weren't paying attention, so I was going to see if I could cough my liver up on you. But just a magic trick, please don't panic. This was magic back in my day. We'd cough up some parchment. And we didn't have Chris Angel and all these magicians you guys have nowadays. Sawing people in half, you know. We had one magician who tried that, but he ended up in jail. I don't agree with that kind of act. When my young wife, Virginia, who I mentioned earlier, when she lay dying, unfortunately, this took many, many months to happen. And people would come up to me all the time, and they'd say, Edgar, Ed, don't worry. She may be passing away, as they'd say. She may be passing away, but someday the two of you will be reunited in heaven. And every time they'd say that to me, I'd thank them because they were trying to make me feel better. But every time they'd say it, it would remind me of the simple fact that where I had no doubt in my mind that Virginia would ascend to heaven as soon as she passed away, I had a lot of doubt whether or not I would ever gain entrance into such a lofty place. You see, I had by no means led the kind of life that would gain me entrance into heaven. So every time they'd say, Edgar, don't worry about it, someday the two of you will be reunited, it would remind me of the fact that when Virginia died, I would probably never see her again. And I haven't. And so, I wrote a poem about a man who longs to be reunited with his dearly departed lover in heaven. But by the end of the poem, he realizes not only has he now died, but he is in eternal hell. And eternal hell to him is simply eternity without her. And I called this poem The Raven. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "rapping at my chamber door. Only this, and nothing more. Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow. Sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels named Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, 'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more.' Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. 'Sir,' said I, 'or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore? This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Back into my chamber turning, all my soul within me burning, soon again I heard a tapping, somewhat louder than before. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more. Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance, matey, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door. Perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door. Perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird, beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou, said I, art sure no craven, ghastly, grim, and ancient raven wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door with such a name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on that placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing further than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before. On the morrow, he will leave me as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken. Doubtless, said I, what it utters is its only stock in store, caught from some unhappy master whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven, still beguiling all my fancy into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then, upon its velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking, what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl, whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining with my head at ease, reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press. Ah, never more. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled upon the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee respite, respite and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh, quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil. Prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, and by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden, whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden, whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting. Bird or fiend, I shrieked upstarting, get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie. Thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken and quit the bust above my door.
take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door. Quote the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting. Still is sitting on that pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. And the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted. Never more. Thank you. Thank you very much. Didn't mean to bring you all down, but this is Edgar Allan Poe. They announced that ahead of time, didn't they? All right, good. Come on in. Everybody's snapping. Hi, how are you? So the raven. So let's move on a bit. How many of you still to this day, I know this has been 160 years since I died anyhow, how many of you listen to poetry every single day of your life? Huh? Just one snap on that one? All right, let me reword that. How many of you listen to music or beats that happen to have words that kind of rhyme every day? Okay. All of you, yeah? Okay. You guys, poetry is still a huge part of your life. You just might seem a little disconnected from it. It's in your music and your rap and all this other stuff. It's still changing the language, just like I made up the word thereat, you know, go see what thereat is. You guys have Snoop Doggy Dog making up something for shizzle or snizzle or, you know, it's all poetry. So whether you listen to George Jones or Tom Jones or the Jonas Brothers or Mike Jones, who? Mike Jones. Oh, you guys, some of you got that. Okay, good. I didn't know if that would, Mike Jones. A lot of people back there saying, who? Don't act like you don't know my name. So no matter who you listen to, somebody's sitting around writing that poetry for these people. Either they're writing it themselves or, you know, it could be a committee. There could be three people sitting around saying, no, I think there should be four mys. And then two mys, and someone else going, no, there should be two mys, and then four mys. They go, no, it'd be much better if it was my poker face, my poker face. And someone's like, no, it should be my poker face, my. They're your poets. So please, guys, go on out and write some of this stuff for them. Moving right along, this next poem is simply about one man's search for that, or maybe every man's search for that legendary city of gold. El Dorado. And he finds out in the end, perhaps, that it only exists in the afterlife. Speaking of afterlife, what's with my portrait up here? You guys couldn't get one when I was 17? I guess maybe I didn't get a lot of paintings done back then. But anyhow, okay, fine. I'm like 90 in that, you know, like 39 and a half. That was like a week before I died there. we'll get into how I died later. There's a lot of speculation on how Edgar Allan Poe died. Although, of course, modern science and modern medicine is always coming up with new theories. Their newest theory, I don't know if you've heard about this, but is that it was actually the swine flu. H1N1. No, I kid you guys. I don't know. I was in a coma, so I missed it. And now, El Dorado by... Well, by me. Gaily bedight, a gallant knight, in sunshine and in shadow, had journeyed long, singing a song, in search of El Dorado. But he grew old, this knight so bold, and over his heart a shadow fell as he found no spot of ground that looked like El Dorado. And as his strength failed him at length, he met a pilgrim shadow. Shadow, said he, where can it be, this land of El Dorado? O'er the mountains of the moon, down the valley of the shadow. Ride, boldly ride, the shade replied, if you seek for El Dorado. Thank you. Moving right along, this next one you guys probably all read when you're in high school. How many of you have read The Telltale Heart. Goodness sakes. Okay. Has anybody not read it? How many of you were supposed to read it and never did? Okay, good. now you finally find out what it's all about. The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. Mm-hmm. True. Nervous. Very, very dreadfully nervous. I had been to NM. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was my sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth, and I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It's impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object? There was none. Passion? There was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me, never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold. And so, by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You fancy me mad? Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch on his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, so that no light shone out. And then I thrust in my head. You would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my head within that opening so far that I might see him as he lay upon his bed. Huh. Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well within the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did. For 7 long nights, every night, just at midnight. But I found the eye always closed, and so it was impossible for me to do my work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he had passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night, just at midnight, I looked upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph to think that there I was, opening the door little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly as if started. Now, you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch, with a thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers. And so I knew he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on. Steadily, I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening and the old man sprang up in bed crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour, I did not move a muscle. Meantime, I did not hear him lie down. No, he was still sitting up in bed, listening, just as I have done, night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the walls. Presently, I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was a groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or grief, oh no. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when it is overcharged with awe. I knew that sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it has welled up from my own bosom, deepening with its dreadful echo the tears that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and I pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since that first slight noise when he had turned in bed. His fears had ever since been growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, oh, it was nothing but the wind in the chimney, or it was only a mouse crossing the floor, or it was merely a cricket which has made a single chirp. Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions, but he had found it all in vain. All in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither heard nor saw, to feel the presence of my head within his room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little, crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. Oh, you cannot imagine how stealthily, until at length a simple dim ray, like the thread of a spider, shot from out the crevice and fell full upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it all with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow of my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face nor person, for I had directed that ray as if by instinct precisely upon that damn spot. Now, have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but an over-acuteness of the senses? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart, and it increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates a soldier into courage. But even yet, I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye, but in the meantime, the hellish tattoo of that heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say! Louder every moment. Do you mark me well? Have I not told you that I'm nervous? So I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. But even yet, I refrained and kept still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now, a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once and once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for some minutes longer, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the walls. At length it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone. Stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart. I held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. Now, if still you think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe to you the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the boards so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash up, no stain of any kind, no blood spot, whatever. I'd been too wary for that. A tub had caught all. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered three men, who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard during the night by a neighbor. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused, information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled. For what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man I mentioned was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search, search well. And I led them at length to his chamber, showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale. Wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears, but still they sat and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definiteness until at length I found that the noise was not from within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice, and yet the sound increased. And what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why did we not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh God, what can I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards, but the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no. No, they heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now, again, hark! Louder! 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 Friends, I shriek! Dissemble no more! I admit the deed! Tear up the planks! Here! Here! It is the beating of his hideous heart! Thank you. Just swing that open for just a sec. Sorry, I just need to swing the doors open for just a second. That piece is getting harder and harder to do. It was fine back when I was like 180, but now that I'm 200, I don't know. Thanks, please. I don't recall it being this hot 160 years ago. Has something changed? Huh? It's like the It's like the entire planet is a tenth of a degree warmer. I don't know how you can handle it. That's all right, kids. Don't panic. I've been doing this show now for 160 years. You'll attest. No, seriously. Well, you haven't been here the whole 160 years. But you'll attest to what I'm about to say. Every 40 or 50 years, I got to change that joke from global warming to global cooling. Global warming. So don't panic. That's true. You've been here, right? You might remember. But it always works. It's fine. There's always some dude gets up in the back. Dude, that's not funny. There's going to be an ice age by 1980. I'm like, all right, okay. Actually, one of the reasons I come alive now is because I want to be here for the end of the world in 2012. So that's... Is that not common knowledge at this point? Ooh, never mind. Forget I said anything. Didn't mean to let the cat out of the bag. Whoops. Boy, those Masons sure can keep a secret, huh? Okay. Very good. Okay, well, never mind anything what I said there. Just 2012. Give out your Christmas presents like 4 days early. No big deal. Just safe. Better safe than sorry. All right, very good. So this next poem is a love poem. But this one has kind of a romantic happy ending, unlike my other love poems that kind of end all sad and everything. This one starts out sad in that the guy is upset because his girlfriend has died, you know. But unlike the Raven, this one, the guy for decades, decades and decades, years and years and years, he gets to sleep right next to her rotting, decaying corpse. So kind of a romantic. Is that no longer considered romantic? Gosh, everything has changed. Okay, well, in my day, that was a very romantic ending. No, here. Let me just put this into perspective. You guys don't know because you're too young. Back in my day, it was quite common to get buried alive. Not because people were malicious. It's just that it was up to us. The family members had to, you know, say, looks like Uncle Albert's dead there. You know, okay, he does look dead. We'd better bury him. It's not like, you know, Pegasus will fly into UVA and they'll hook you up to a million machines and go, yeah, he's dead, you know. In my day, it was up to the family members. We couldn't just put you on a horse and ride you into town and for 7 days and then back. It was up to us. And so you'd hear about it, especially as a kid. You'd hear of stories of people who got buried alive, you know. They dug him up to put in a root cellar and realized he'd been clawing at the inside of his coffin trying to get out. And so you'd hear these stories as a kid. And so here was our high-tech solution. Here's what we would do. You could get this as part of your package when you're getting buried. They'd put a bell on your tombstone with a cord or a piece of rawhide going all the way down into the ground into your coffin. And if you woke up in a coffin, you're like, what'd they do? They buried me alive. You'd reach around, you'd find that string and yank on it. The bell would ring, and hopefully everyone from town would come and dig you up. There's where your expression, saved by the bell, comes from. I'm not kidding. It really comes from there. Saved by the Bell. I know a lot of you go, no way, that's Ricky Schroeder from 1980s sitcom. No, it goes back further than that. You're a dead ringer for so-and-so. If someone says you're a dead ringer, that's again where that comes from. It looks like they rang that bell and came back to life. So if you were a young guy, and like I was when Mrs. Allen died, I had learned to love Mrs. Allen just like she was my mother. Because again, I was 3 when I lost my mother. My father had left us before my mother even died. He was some actor. And although so was my mom, but the point is, I had learned to love Mrs. Allen, and then she died, and of course all the adults were telling me, now she's dead, you know, and they were hauling her off to bury her. So when Mrs. Allen died, I didn't believe it, and they hauled her off and buried her in the ground. In Annabelle Lee, I put the character's girlfriend in a tomb or a sepulcher, which makes it a lot easier for visitation. But they put Mrs. Allen in the ground, and I didn't believe that she was dead. They were all just shoving me aside. You know how it is when you're young and just the adopted kid. And they know better, and you don't know what you're talking about. And so what I would do is I'd sneak out at night, after she died, and I'd sneak up to her graveyard, and I'd listen to the ground to hear if I could hear something. So I'd listen to the ground, and then I'd fall asleep there. Of course, she was really dead. I was wrong, but I thought I was going to be a big hero and run into town and tell everyone, I heard her. And so I'd fall asleep there, and they'd find me sleeping in the morning on her grave, and a lot was made of that. But you'll have to dig up Sigmund Freud for that one. This next one is simply a poem about, well, I already told you what it's about, Annabelle. It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived, whom you may know by the name of Annabelle Lee. And this maiden, she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child, and she was a child in this kingdom by the sea. But we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee, with a love that the winged seraphs of heaven coveted her and me. And this was the reason that long ago in this kingdom by the sea, a wind blew out of a cloud, chilling my beautiful Annabel Lee, so that her high-born kinsmen came and bore her away from me to shut her up in a sepulcher in this kingdom by the sea. The angels, not half so happy in heaven, went envying her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know, in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of a cloud by night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we. And neither the angels in heaven above, nor the demons down under the sea, can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. For the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And the stars never rise, but I feel the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And so, all the night tide, I lie down by the side of my darling. My darling, my life, and my bride. In her sepulcher, there by the sea. In her tomb, by the sounding sea. Thank you. This next poem is my last one. Let's see, did I cover everything I was going to cover? I talked about my days here. I think I was talking earlier about the sweatshirts that you guys are wearing around with my likeness. Did we talk about that, how it was just because Mr. Allen wouldn't give me any more money? Okay, that's the only reason I dropped out. And then what it was I had kind of a gambling problem and a few other substance abuse thingies. Just ignore all that. The point is, I after UVA, I thought, well, I better get some discipline in my life. So I joined the military. I went to West Point. I thought that would sober me up and straighten me out, you know. Of course, first thing I did was get drunk and tell everyone I was a direct descendant of Benedict Arnold. You know, that went over really well. And then I didn't last long at that establishment either. So this next poem, do you know who else is 200 years old this year? You both are right. Very good. Abraham Lincoln, Charles Darwin. Of course, Abraham Lincoln was born in 1809, just like I was, but I died long before he became president. We all knew he'd become president. I mean, his face was on a penny. How hard is it to become president when you're on the penny? Charles Darwin, he wrote his theory of evolution when he was in his 20s. But he didn't dare publish it until he was well into his 50s. So I was dead before that came out. Again, maybe it would have explained things a little more. We had to go by other philosophies that had been around, some of them for a long time. Maybe you've heard of this one that was popular in my time, that the days of our lives are like the grains of sand through an hourglass. Have you heard of this one? You have? Oh, very good. I know, because you probably saw Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Is that it? Cool. So you all know who said that. Who said it? Socrates, dude, yeah. Oh, by the way, Keanu Reeves, one and only good part he ever played. Yeah. Don't even bother watching any of his other movies, but that one's a good one. So Socrates, or Socrates, as they used to call them, came up with that philosophy. Here's one more philosophy, though, that we had back in my day, was that this is just a dream. And that someday you wake up from this dream, and that's what death is, waking up from this dream. And, oh, wow, you know, it was such a realistic dream, and you were there, and you were there, and Auntie M, you know. And so this next poem is simply my take on those two little philosophies, and I call this one A Dream Within a Dream. Is there any way we can get the lights off for this? And now, A Dream Within a Dream by Edgar Allan Poe. Take this kiss upon the brow, and
in parting from you now. Thus much let me avow. You are not wrong who deem that my days have been a dream. Yet if hope has flown away in a night or in a day, in a vision or in none, is it therefore the less gone? All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. I stand amid the roar of a surf-tormented shore and hold within my hand grains of the golden sand. How few, yet how they creep through my fingers to the deep while I weep. While I weep, oh God, can I not grasp them with a tighter clasp? Oh God, can I not save one from the pitiless wave? Is all that we see or seem but a dream within a dream? Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Do we have time for a couple of questions? Okay, I was just informed. Thank you very much, you guys. It's great to be appreciated. I was just informed we had time for like two or three questions. And then I got to roll out and you guys get on with some historical speeches. I hope you all have them prepared. Does anybody have any questions? Let me introduce myself, by the way. My name is Scott Craig Jones. I'm an actor. You can look me up if you want. I have my theater called the Traveling Jones Theater, straight out of the Lynyrd Skynyrd song. I tour around middle schools, high schools, libraries, universities, things like that with my one-man Edgar Allan Poe show at this point in my life. So that's me. Any questions? Yes. Well, I'm sure the university, his Poe's time at the university influenced the rest of his life. You know, how could it not? And will influence the rest of your guys' lives, too. Sure, I mean, come on. In terms of how much he wrote here as opposed to other places, I don't think he was here long enough to have written that much. Poe considered himself a poet, so probably some of the poetry he wrote while he was here, you know. And then later in life, he had to try and earn a living, so he started editing and all this stuff. He was trying to become America's first writer, who's, you know, a paid writer who earned his living just from writing. Of course, he didn't succeed. You guys think of him as this great, big, famous writer, but I don't have to tell you guys. I mean, he sold The Raven for $10 4 years before he died. Thought he was on his way. he was under the influence, I mean, of this school quite a bit. Next question. Any other questions? Yes. Poe's death. Yeah, thank you very much. Poe's death, the most recent, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of theories over the years. It was at rabies at one point people were thinking, and then discounted that. The absolute most recent theory is, and it comes from a day where they moved Poe's body. They dug him up and moved him because he was just buried out back with the bums. And then when he became famous after he was dead, they were, oh, we've got Edgar Allan Poe buried here. Look how, oh, isn't this great? Let's display him. And so they moved him, and fortunately they kept record of that day. And one of the guys who was the grave diggers commented that, you know, of course the coffin was collapsed and everything, but he commented that he looked into Poe's eye socket, and he claimed and he swore he could still see Poe's brain. And his comment was how smart Poe was, that his brain was still intact. And of course, anybody who watches Bones or whatever knows that brain's first thing to putrefy. It's gone. It turns into mush. Modern science believes that that was a brain tumor he was looking at, because it would look much like a brain or something, or brain particle, and it wouldn't decompose that easily, unfortunately, which is one of the problems with tumors, is it's hard to get rid of them. So it would be just like sinew or hair or anything like that. It would stick around. So that's the biggest, most recent, if you look in the American medical journals, what they're saying is that it was probably a brain tumor. It acted like a brain tumor. He went into the coma and then died and was having problems, you know, for a few months before he died. That's why he quit drinking and all that stuff. But again, there's tons of theories. Plenty of people wrote about him after he died who didn't like him during life, So we've got all their theories on it, you know, that he was drunk or that it was electioneering or some of that stuff going on. But there's one good plausible theory. Any other questions? We got time for like one more. Why do I do Poe? Well, first of all, it's really well written. So that helps. Second of all, because I wanted to tour to schools and make money doing that, I wanted something that fit right into what they're called, their SOLs and all that stuff. So it was something that they were studying, and so they could justify hiring me in. But it all started really in high school, way back in 1980. I'm almost as old as Poe. But it started back in high school, my senior project for high school drama class. I did the Telltale Heart. And since I already had that much memorized, every time I'd think, oh, I got to do a one-man show, I'd go, oh, I'll do some Poe. And then I'll add to it. So that now it's actually an hour and a half long show. But really the first thing, it wasn't really a literary thing. It was because maybe two of you in this room might remember a TV show called Dark Shadows. It was a soap opera, all black and white, really scary thing that I used to watch when I was like, you know, like eight, and he used to give me nightmares. And then there was an album that came out called Welcome to My Nightmare by Alice Cooper, which, of course, I had on 8-track, again, to date myself. And that kind of influenced me to this kind of darker, more macabre stuff. So anyhow, you guys have been wonderful. Keep up the good work and keep the good name of the Jefferson Society going. Thank you.